This is part of my work I did with my PhD at UC Riverside, and this is with my co-authors Emil Stefanov from Berkeley and Elaine Shi from University of Maryland. So with Burst ORM, we're trying to solve a couple of problems. The larger problem is, how do we provide access pattern privacy for outsourced data? And access pattern privacy is a strong privacy definition that I'll describe in a minute. But this, we can achieve it using a suite of techniques called called Oblivious RAM, or Oblivious Storage. And so within that, we'd like to create an ORAM, or Oblivious RAM technique specifically that gives us low response times on bursty workloads. And so that's where Burst ORM comes in this for this contrived set of parameters on this data set designed to make things look good here. We can take the response times down from as much as 3 hours in our closest competitor, or one of the most bandwidth efficient ORAMs out there, to closer to 56. Closer to 50 milliseconds, which is near optimal. Okay, so here's where we're headed with the talk. I'm going to start by talking through the larger problem of private data outsourcing and how Oblivious RAM can allow us to do that, and then the specific problem of practical response times and Burst ORAM. I'll then give some details on Burst ORAM and talk through the results of some simulations we did. So we're going to be looking at this typical cloud or data outsourcing model where you have a resource-constrained client who wants to store data on the cloud, or what we call the server here, in order to take advantage of economy of scale and improve accessibility and availability. Typically, we assume that today we assume that the cloud provider is going to do an adequate job of taking care of our data, and we just store it plain text to the provider. But this may not work for all clients who have particularly sensitive data that they're not willing to trust the provider with, or they may just be unable to because the data is perhaps patient records or something where there are privacy regulations limiting what can be done with the data. So we'd like such clients to still be able to take advantage of these cloud services in such a way that they can be sure their data, information about their data is not leaking. So the basic approach here would be to encrypt the data before storing it to the server. But encryption alone is insufficient to protect privacy of the data, as we can see from some existing attacks in the literature where access patterns, or the sequence of accesses to the encrypted data, were enough to leak information about the ordering of these records, the encrypted records based on their plain text values, or in some cases, the contents of search queries over encrypted email. So Oblivious RAM allows us to achieve this, protect the privacy of the access patterns as well. So it's a suite of techniques that were first proposed by Goldreich and Ostrovsky in 1996. It gives us provable access pattern privacy, meaning that nothing will leak, no information leaks about the particular sequence of plain text blocks that are accessed by the client. You can think of ORAM as sitting as a protocol in the trusted client side that translates the client's requests for blocks by plain text block ID into a sequence of requests to the encrypted blocks stored on the server. So a client would issue a request for maybe plain text block 1. The ORAM would translate that into a sequence of requests to the encrypted blocks on the server. We're going to request extra blocks in order to obfuscate which block the client is actually interested in. And then the ORAM will return the appropriate block to the client. This is, of course, a drastic simplification of how it works, but gives you the rough idea. So that is the part of the I.O. that we call the online I.O. At this point, the request can be marked satisfied, and the block has been returned to the client. There's some additional work, which we'll call offline I.O. or shuffling commonly, which is needed in order to prepare the server to satisfy additional requests while maintaining this obliviousness. OK, so that's ORAM. Now onto the specific problem of how do we get the response times to be practical. So there are several costs associated with ORAM that are explored, and there are a lot of trade-offs between them. We have the cost of transferring these extra blocks in terms of bandwidth, which we're going to define the bandwidth cost to be just the number of blocks we actually transfer divided by the number of requests. So in a scheme without ORAM, this would just be one. In some cases, we end up storing extra blocks on the server that are dummy blocks that don't contain real data, so that incurs server space overhead. And there are also different amounts of space on the client that can be required depending on the particular scheme. This is just a smattering of existing ORAM work. It's by no means exhaustive, but you can see some of the different costs. In the right column, you can see the bandwidth cost has gone down from polylogarithmic in n to log n with no constants, or no hidden constants, in the case of the oblivistore technique at the bottom. That means for a database with n blocks, we actually have to transfer log n blocks per request in order to achieve this access pattern privacy. But you can see there's also a big difference in client space, ranging from constant in the Kuchelevitz et al. Scheme, all the way down to something even linear in the size of the database, although linear with a very low constant, so you still get 100 to 1,000 factor improvement in the total space, what you can store on the server versus what space you have on the client. Okay, so none of these, there's been very little work on actually what are the response times, and especially trying to make them practical. So by response time, we just mean the time between when a request is actually issued by the client and when it's satisfied. And the reason is that in the typical ORAM model, you would just assume this endless sequence of stream of requests coming in, or that the requests are coming in at a fixed rate, and you satisfy them all as quickly as possible, in which case, reducing your bandwidth cost really does reduce your response times anyway. But that's not the case if your workload is bursty, as is common for a lot of real-world workloads. So a simple example here, we have all these 10 requests for the first burst on the left come in at the same time, and we can do some amount of I/O in parallel based on the available bandwidth we have, but in this case, we can do about 4 requests worth of work at once. So we can satisfy the first 2 requests in the burst very quickly. Their online I/O is complete. They'll be satisfied at this point here. And then, by the time the 10th request is satisfied, we've done all of the online I/O and a lot of the offline I/O for all of these prior requests. And so the response times can be quite long. So we'd like to improve this situation. And that's where burst ORAM comes in. Our goals are to reduce the response times while keeping the total bandwidth cost low. Burst ORAM is based on the oblivistore ORAM I mentioned, which has an extremely low bandwidth cost. It's the most bandwidth efficient ORAM, and I believe still is. But it incurs a very large amount of client space, very large client space cost to do so. So burst ORAM shares those characteristics, but we also want to add in the ability to get response times very low. So burst ORAM does this in 3 different ways. The first is we want to reduce the online I/O, so that amount of work that we actually have to do before a request is satisfied. That allows us to satisfy the individual request very quickly, but we end up with more offline or shuffling I/O to do. So the next step is to delay that shuffling work as long as possible, preferably until an idle period where it won't affect response times. That's mostly in paper, there's some details on that, but it's mostly an engineering challenge to utilize client space efficiently and not reach a deadlock situation. Is when we delay shuffling, what we're really doing is just storing the blocks that we've downloaded so far on the client, and we can't push them back to the server until we do this shuffling or offline I/O step. Eventually, client space does fill up, and when it does, we need to start doing some shuffling work, and so the third step is to prioritize the most efficient shuffling work. So we want a scheduling policy for choosing which pieces of work to do that's going to still be oblivious and not leak information to the server, but at the same time, we'll do the work that gives us the most value. So it'll free the most space on the client using the least amount of I/O. So here's how things would look in are going to look in burst ORAM. So we have reduced On the right, you can see we've reduced the amount of online I/O for each of the requests, but we end up with more offline I/O, but we can delay that until after all of the requests have been satisfied, unless we get shorter response times. Okay. I'm going to go over some of the details. This is, again, a simplification of how things work, but I'm especially going to focus on how the XOR technique works in BurstORM to reduce online I/O. So at a high level, BurstORM and OblivioStore are laid out similarly. The blocks on the server are grouped logically into these square root of n partitions, each of which contains square root n blocks. Each partition is itself a hierarchical ORAM structure. And each request will be routed to a single one of these partitions. And the details on why that is secure, that I'll refer you to the paper. But we're going to look at how the behavior of one of these partitions differs between OblivioStore and BurstORM. So in OblivioStore, and in both cases, the blocks are laid out hierarchically within one of the partitions. Half of the blocks are real and half are dummies. The short version of shuffling is that at some point when we push blocks back, they'll come in, they'll filter in through the top levels and down. Shuffles will eventually cascade and they'll get pushed into the lower levels, which get reshuffled less frequently. But the dummy blocks contain just arbitrary data created by the client, but they're indistinguishable from the real blocks that contain the client data. So when we make a request, we need to make sure it looks just like any other request to the server, so we always request exactly one block from each occupied level. At most, one of the blocks is real, because we only need one block of data, and the choice of block within the level appears random to the server, even though it's really deterministic by the client, because of the way the blocks are created originally and stored in those levels. So we do the four blocks that we read, one from each level, is the online cost. At that point, the request can be satisfied. Then we do some amount of offline or shuffling work that gets the partition ready to handle subsequent requests. Again, this is a simplification visually of how it works, but this is the idea. So by the time we've satisfied the third request, say in a burst of requests all coming in at once, we've done all of this online and offline I/O, and there's very little we have to do during the idle period. So with BurstORM, we want to reduce this online cost component on the left and delay or minimize the offline cost. So in BurstORM, what we do instead, we still have to fetch one block from each level, just like we did before, because just grabbing the real block would reveal to the server some information. But we only need one block of information to actually come back to the client. So what we do is XOR all of these blocks together and just return that combined block to the client. So in order to retrieve the real block, the client has to reconstruct the dummy blocks locally and subtract them out of this combined XORed block. And since the client gets to control dummy blocks, it can just use a pseudo-random function and encrypt the output of that to create dummy blocks in the first place so it can efficiently reconstruct them and subtract them out. So what this does is reduce the online cost to one block in this, regardless of the number of levels. And then coupled with the techniques I mentioned briefly for delaying and prioritizing the shuffling I/O, we get less offline cost during this burst. So by the time we've satisfied the third request, we've done, in this example, only five blocks of I/O. And we still have to catch up on all that other work, but now we can do it during an idle period where it's not going to affect these response times. I also want to mention this is well suited to of a mobile device scenario in that while you're out on battery and on an expensive wireless connection, you can do less bandwidth, less work, fewer transfers. And then when you get home to a power source and a less expensive connection, you can catch up on all of this shuffling work you would need to do. Okay, I'm going to talk about the results of some simulations we did to see how well BurstORM performs. What you can see here is we're looking at the bandwidth cost associated with each request as a burst progresses. So on the y-axis is the bandwidth cost, on the x is the index of a request in a burst. OblivioStore, you can see the line halfway up, incurs about the same bandwidth cost per request regardless of the position into the burst because it tries to keep the cost per request consistent. And BurstORM, the cost starts out at 1, which is just that one block we have to retrieve from the server, until client space fills up, at which point we have to start doing some amount of shuffling work in order to push blocks back to the server and free more space for subsequent requests. By using the job prioritization or the shuffle prioritization technique I mentioned, we get more of a graceful degradation to the cost of Oblivistore, and we can keep the burst going efficiently for longer, and thus keep response times lower for longer bursts. So this graph shows a simulation we ran on a real-world NetApp trace. On the y-axis, you can see the 99.9% response time, which is the time such that 99.9% of the requests finished in less than this time. So it's close to a worst case, but results are similar for some other percentiles as well. You can see the paper for some more details. On the x-axis is the amount of bandwidth with which we provision the system in the simulation. With a very, very large bandwidth, the particular technique doesn't matter so much, as regardless of the size of the burst, we can handle everything in parallel. With very small bandwidth, even the technique without ORAM is going to fall behind because it just can't keep up with the rate of requests. So what you can see is burst ORAM tracks very nicely with the optimal or without ORAM case. And Oblivistore is orders of magnitude higher in terms of these 99.9% response times, just because it doesn't do anything to accommodate these bursts, and so it'll get behind on requests right away. If you zoom in a little, you can see it's not perfect. We're 20 to 30 milliseconds over for this 400 to 500 megabit per second range, but it's still far better than the Oblivistore work. So the response times clearly have come down, or at least the worst case ones. How did we do in terms of keeping the total bandwidth cost low? You can see we actually incur more bandwidth cost total using burst ORAM than we do with Oblivistore. You might think it would be lower because we're combining these blocks, and so we have fewer blocks to actually transfer. And the reason it's not is there's another optimization used by Oblivistore called level compression, and the two techniques are mutually incompatible. Because of the way the dummy blocks are generated to support each technique. So their technique is somewhat more efficient in terms of total bandwidth, but ours does a better job of reducing the online I/O cost and thus allows us to reduce the response times. So we incur some 33% higher bandwidth cost in this example, but that's a small price to pay for the dramatic reduction in response times. So in conclusion, we've achieved practical response times during burst and kept the bandwidth cost low, competitive with the best existing ORAM technique. And one of the downsides to burst ORAM is it doesn't do anything, as I mentioned, to reduce the total bandwidth cost. So for future work, we'd like to explore techniques that can still achieve these very practical response times while bringing the bandwidth cost, total bandwidth cost, even lower. So that concludes my talk, and I'll take questions.
We have lots of time for questions. You can go to the mic on that side, or I can bring it over here.
So I missed the first 2 minutes, so I apologize if this is stupid. So the goal of doing the offline shuffling is to, in part, help prevent frequency analysis on the server side to try and determine which blocks are real and which are dummies, correct?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the end.
Sorry. So part of the goal of doing this offline shuffling is to prevent frequency analysis on the server side to determine which blocks are real and which are dummies, correct?
Yes, that's a component of it. So the shuffling has the, and the entire ORAM protocol has the behavior of obscuring which particular plain text blocks were requested and breaking associations between one request and another. So whether the client requests six of the exact same block in a row or six completely different blocks, the access pattern to the server looks the same because of the shuffling and such. And also obscures whether it's a read or a write. And yes, the real and a lot of these are required, some of this stuff is required to keep the real blocks and the dummy blocks indistinguishable from each other also.
Okay. So in the previous schemes, shuffling happened like online during normal operations, and part of your innovation is to shift that opportunistically to when it's idle and there's not a lot of activity going on.
Yes, that's correct. So there's a shift to pushing the shuffling toward an idle time. That's the primary. Okay. That's one of the components to burst ORAM. A lot of the existing ORAMs could have done that part themselves to some degree. Oblivious Store is particularly well suited for it because of the way it works. But the ORAMs, especially that try to use a very limited client space, have a very limited capacity for delaying their shuffling because you need space on the client to kind of cache your results in the meantime.
Okay. Has there been much work, either in other papers or in yours, on trying to figure out the trade-off, and the longer that I go between reshuffles, the more vulnerable I become to the frequency analysis or other attacks?
So that does not occur in general ORAMs. There are, as in ORAM, you only will delay shuffling, like in this case, if it's not going to make you vulnerable at all. So we still maintain the same privacy guarantees as a traditional ORAM would in this case. There's other work on non-ORAM, but more best effort privacy techniques for this that do have those kinds of comparisons. Yeah.
Thank you.
Sure.
Hi, Sia Dashti from Newcastle University. I was just wondering, this might be an uninteresting case, but what happens if the size of the burst is comparable to the size of your database? I mean, the database is small or the burst is too big.
Okay, so you're asking what happens when bursts are very long. Right, so you can see in the one graph I had. Let's see. Oops, sorry. All right, well, I guess I'll just answer. When the bursts become very long, we end up converging to the cost of Oblivious Store or something, because the advantages you get from delaying, you can't really delay work indefinitely, and so eventually it catches up and you just converge to essentially the same cost as Oblivious Store with slight difference. So, does that answer the question? Okay.
All right, let's thank the speaker again.